This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Good morning, Ireland and the world.
With the general condition, it's a continual losing of things.
When Ferg calls you, it's like a call to arms. What I really want is for him to put this record out while he's still alive.
It helps to have a bit of madness in you.
I love you.
Hungry for life.
I can't play the instruments anymore, so instead of playing instruments, I have to play people.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Hello, filmmakers. I hope you're doing well out there. Welcome to another episode of FNI Rap Chat. This is a very special one. This is with the filmmaker Michael McCormick, who made the film Breaking Out. We actually recorded this interview around this time last year when it was originally supposed to be released. And then, unfortunately, because of lockdown, they held off until this week, and it is now finally in cinemas. I got to hear the whole story of this kind of unlikely film, almost this unlikely story of Fergus, an incredible musician and an incredible spirit, who died at the age of only 48, I believe, in 2016, and the lead singer of Interference. So We know documentaries can take a long time, but Michael McCormick was making this for 10 years and following the story of Fergus and his illness, his struggle with muscular dystrophy, you know, a man who was told he would only live until he was 18. And yeah, it went back further than that. Michael was following this band since the 80s as a fan. And there was just so many twists and turns in the story, and to see Fergus kind of find fame after many years of kind of obscurity with the success of Once, and to see him kind of reborn. And it's just it's a film that sounds like it could be kind of grim and sad and depressing, but it's not. It's extremely joyous. So if you can get out there and see it or rent it online, do so. It is released by Element Distribution. You will find it where you find anything good. It was a brilliant chat with Michael. I mean, talk about perseverance and to go through this journey and to be, you know, so close with the subject. It's a heartbreaking story, but also, you know, quite uplifting. So even just the story behind the making of it. So we hope you enjoy this one. This is Michael McCormick.
I watched the film last night. I absolutely loved it. It's quite emotional. It's such a journey. I was kind of aware of Fergus's story. I knew some of his music going way back, and I'd kind of been aware of the film. So I'm really excited to kind of get stuck in into the journey. But just for our listeners, just to get a bit of background to yourself, I believe this is your first film. So maybe you could just give us a bit of background to how you ended up coming to this project.
Yeah. It's good talking to you.
And I have to go way back, so cut in at any stage because this could go on. Okay. So basically, I'm like most people, and when I was a teenager, I was bonkers about music and I ended up trying to help out at gigs as much as I could. And in 1987, I think it was, or it might have been 86, there was a charity concert called Self Aid. And it was a massive concert for the unemployed in Ireland. It was a bit odd, but a lot of gigs happened all over the country as part of that. And at one of these, at age 15, I was doing backline, and all these bands from around Ireland were playing. And the majority of them weren't really doing anything for me, to be honest. And then this band came on stage, and this guy started singing, and they looked far more confident and sure of themselves than I'd seen in an Irish band before. And I was completely hooked from that moment. So when he came off stage and got into a wheelchair, I went over and sat down and you know, chewed the ear off him. And that was Fergus O'Farrell. And I went along to loads of gigs after that and became a huge fan. And could see around me at all these gigs that all the great and good of the up-and-coming music scene in Dublin at the time, the Frames, the Mary Janes, Keela, Mundy, all these artists were all going along to see Interference, because we all knew that this was something special. So when they broke up, it kind of, you know, affected everybody. And when they got back together again in the 2000s, I ended up going along to see them again, and one of the members of the band came up and said, knew what I was doing, knew that I was making documentaries, and said to me, would you ever think of making one about him? And I kind of thought at the time, you know, music documentaries and music in general wasn't getting as much support as it used to. And I thought, is there an audience for it? It's a very niche audience, because Interference were a very niche cult band. And then I went down and spent a weekend with Ferguson and Skull, and I just put a camera on him for the weekend, and he never shut up. And by the end of the weekend, I went away realizing that it was a much bigger story, and that it was, you know, going to be an amazing story to tell, and that it was well worth getting stuck in. So I made all the big mistakes that filmmakers make, because I got stuck in straight away, started filming myself, and without a budget, and then started trying to raise awareness about that through Film Ireland, and you know, but I never stopped filming. So I ended up filming for over 10 years, and so I saw a hell of a lot of the highs and lows of Fergus's life, but I kind of always knew that if I could get to the stage where I could raise the right budget, that I could tell the story the way it needed to be told. And I actually always thought that that would be when Fergus was still around. But I've since learned when he passed away that he had no intention of letting me finish it until he brought me all the way. But so it took a long time to make this film. But eventually I was able to make it the way that it needed to be made, because his life was a bit unbelievable. It was like a fairy tale. And on paper, it was hard to sell, because it sounded like it could be quite a downbeat, depressing story. But I hope you agree, it's far from that. It's an uplifting story about an incredible life.
Absolutely. And it really makes the film, you know, that it is such a long journey, and it feels like, you know, you can kind of feel that, you can kind of feel what it must have been like almost going along on that journey. And when it takes these kind of highs and lows and turns, and it really does feel like, you know, you kind of think it's going to be something, but it's so much more. It's really special. I guess maybe just you summed up kind of the musical contribution of Interference there. They really were something quite special, coming out of a time when, you know, everyone was looking for that next U2 or whatever, and you kind of you capture something in the film of the, you know, what it's like to be in a band and the highs and lows. Was that kind of a conscious thing to kind of get into that world a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, when you're making when you're telling a story like this, you're really trying to make it evocative, and for people, not only those who were there, but even more importantly for those who weren't there. So one of the great things for me was that Fergus, when he moved up to Dublin to try and become a musician and start a band and make it, he moved into this factory in the middle of Dublin near Christchurch, and it's talked about in the film that people would kind of gravitate to this factory, different bands, and that I think it was Maria Doyle Kennedy says, you know, a place for bewildered musicians, which is what it was, because I remember it myself. But I wanted to get back in there. Unfortunately, that building is situated in Dublin beside the Ivy Market, and it's called Winstanley. It used to be an old shoe factory, and it has been sitting there idle for quite a long time. And so it's a shadow of the building it was at the time, because the building that Fergus and his musician friends lived in and rehearsed in turned into a pub called Mother Red Caps, which was not only a great pub, but a great venue for a good few years before it shut down. So as I said, now it's sitting there idle. So once I decided I had to get back in there, no matter what state it was in, and do the interviews with the band members in there, many of whom hadn't been back since they had lived there, I knew that it would bring an extra level to their experience and the way in which they would tell the story. And, it kind of helps to bring people back there, not just, even though the place doesn't exist in the way it was, it helps to bring people back to where it was all happening.
Yeah, you definitely get that sense. And it was great you kind of set it up very well with some of the other bands. I mean, there were so many great bands at that time, but the churn of how the record company business works, you kind of see the victims there of that. When it comes to your own background, before the project, what kind of experience had you had before working on this film?
So my background is totally in broadcast television. So I would have started out freelancing, working for different independent companies, and then I started to work with RTE. So I have worked in all strands of making broadcast TV. I've made numerous documentaries of all lengths. I've worked in entertainment. I've worked in loads of different areas, so much so that for years I was kind of, my heart and soul was in documentary making, and for years I used to get frustrated when I wasn't able to get stuck into that. And then I realized that actually, apart from being a director and a producer, that what you're trying to do is tell stories and tell them as well as possible. And I'd kind of learned how to tell stories in all different formats, and all different lengths, so that when it's not often that you come across a project that you know straight away that it has feature documentary potential. And as I said, I wasn't sure that this had until I sat down talking to Fergus. So I knew it was a feature doc from the moment I got stuck into it. And I was probably naive enough to think that I knew how to make a feature doc. But of course, I went about it the wrong way, but there was no other way to do it, because when you're somebody who hasn't got any background in that, and this is going to be your first film, it's very hard for people to back that. And then you're also asking them to come on a journey with somebody that basically doesn't look like it has any end, in which your treatment is going to include reconstructions with Oscar-winning actors and animation. It was a hard sell for a lot of people when I'd go into a room. And it really, it was only when I you know, got it finished, that I was able to say that, you know, what I had on paper and what I was trying to sell, that it had actually worked. Because I'm sure it's the same for every filmmaker out there, particularly when you're on a long journey like this. So many times I said to myself, Jesus, have I got this all wrong? Have I, you know, is this what I think it is? Is it just a small little story? And have I just built this up in my own head? But luckily, I kept reminding myself that that no, you don't come across stories like this every day of the week, that there was a reason to keep going. And my only regret is that Fergus isn't here to see it, because I know he'd be kind of tickled pink that it's the film that I talked to him about over those years, because he knew every bit of it. He knew how I was going to approach things. He knew how I was going to tell the story. So he'd get a great kick out of the fact that, you know, Jeremy Irons is leaning down, talking to him in a ditch.
That was going to be my next question, just about his Fergus's involvement in the filmmaking. So he obviously understood, you know, what you were making. It wasn't just, oh yeah, it'd be good to have a camera around, kind of thing.
Pretty much. I mean, in that we had it set up from the early days that I was going to be on a journey. I was going to be there for the high moments and the low moments. That as much as possible, he was to ignore that I was ever there. And you know, actually, the difficult periods of filming were when he didn't do that. When he became too familiar with me and with the camera, he started talking to me, and I we had loads of rows over the years about it, because I said, That doesn't work for me. I said, I I'm not interested in me being, you know, in conversation with you here. It has to be about me just observing and following your story. So, you know, that we had plenty of arguments about that. And he would ask me, you know, when I would ask him to tell me a certain story more than once, I would often tell him to tell me a story again and again until I got him to tell it to me the way he did when the camera wasn't on. And I would explain to him, this is a pivotal story in the film because it says everything about you as a person, and I would like to make a reconstruction about this. And this is another great story, the story about himself and his wife meeting. I said, this is how I want to make, you know, realize this on screen. So he always knew where I was going with things. But essentially, the most important thing for me was to create that, you know, gap between the two of us as well when the filming was happening, because otherwise it would have been a different film.
Okay. And in terms of, that's such a constant challenge for filmmakers, documentary filmmakers, to get things natural. Was there any big lessons from that? Because you a lot of interviews in here that you brought in, that you'd bring into your next film, or that, you know, those kind of skills of how to actually get those natural interviews.
Yeah, well, you know, the funny thing is, Paul, you know, there are so many films that say they're shot over a period of time, and essentially they're not. Yeah. They're not as immersive as you know. It is quite unusual to be talking about Breaking Out and about a film like this. And 100%, this was total immersion, because a lot of the time I would get on the road and go down to West Cork, and I would arrive then, and there might be something going on that, you know, he felt was worth being there for filming, and I would know straight away, no, it's not worth filming. But I would be there to work on the relationship, and that's kind of the thing that, you know, to take from this more than anything else, that there were so many occasions when I would go down and I'd come away from it knowing that none of the footage would be used, and I'd be frustrated. And now, looking back on it, I say to myself, actually, all those times were so important, because I think for a documentary maker, the number one thing I think everybody who makes documentaries will know this, is the relationship you have with the main character and the people that you're filming, that they know they can trust you, and that they know that your intention is the right one, and that they don't have to be concerned. Because let's face it, how many of us would be happy to be, you know, followed around with a camera? I certainly wouldn't be. So when you're going to give somebody the right to do that, you have to trust them. So that's the thing that it would take forward from it, is how important it is to never forget to get that trust, and to maintain it over the course of any approach that you're taking to a film.
Yeah, you definitely get that sense that, you know, you almost feel like you're a part of the family. You're in quite intimate setups there, you know, and situations, and with the family, and for those that is most vulnerable, it's really a testament to the time that you put in there. Was there ever times where you were like, I'm not sure if I should be here?
Oh God, yeah, but I mean, but there's a lot of footage that isn't in the film that I knew when I came back and looked at the footage. I said, that's not going to be in the film, because there were moments of intimacy that I wasn't comfortable with. Fergus had opened up completely to me and wanted me to be there for everything. There was a good period of time when in his life when he wanted to keep the muscular dystrophy at a certain distance, because it didn't define him. You know, anyone who knew him, you could spend years in his company and never think about the suffering he was going through, because it did define him and he didn't allow it to. But towards the last couple of years, he really wanted me to show how difficult it had become, because it wasn't something he shared with too many people. But he, you know, when people wondered, had he become a recluse, he wanted to be able to show people, actually, I'd be out there playing all the time. I'd be out there touring if I could. It's just that this fucking disease has now taken hold of me. Mm-hmm. So there are stages, you know, there are scenes in the film that are there because they feel right, and they're not easy, and they're tough, but there was an awful lot more that didn't make it, and I'm very happy with the stuff that was used in the film, and I'm very happy that he would be as well.
Hello, filmmakers. Just a few updates for FNI. So there is the course with Ewan Bremmer coming up, and Paul actually did an episode of FNI Rap Chat with Ewan, so that will be coming to your ears very soon as well. Lots of talk of Storyland. The deadline is coming quite soon. It is the 12th of December. It's an incredible opportunity. They're really kind of supersizing Storyland. It doesn't look like what it has been over the years. It's grown a lot and had many different variations and different incarnations over the years. But it seems that this one, you know, they're putting a lot more money into it and a lot more development. And it seems like this is going to be the way that RTE find talent and develop projects that will, you know, that hopefully will have a life after Storyland. So check that out on the RTE website, Storyland. There is, you know, it's not a huge application, which is good. So if you have something, you just need, you know, you need to get a producer on board, and you need to get a good pitch and a couple of strong scenes, and get it in there. And best of luck with it. Let's go back to Michael McCormick.
Just on the different techniques, because you utilize, you've got Jeremy Irons in there, you've got a bit of an animation, and it really, you know, makes the the viewing experience so enjoyable. Were they tricky? Because often I know how it is hard to make those things work tonally. Often they're great on paper. What was the challenge there for you? Like,
well, the main challenge, Paul, is that every room I went into and told the people that I wanted to do though, particularly those two things, I would get these kind of looks. You know, these are people I was trying to get on board in funding and supporting the film.
I know those looks very well.
Yeah, I mean, and I understand it completely because, you know, there was a period of time there where with documentary making, it seemed that animation was being utilized too much. It seemed that reconstruction is a scary one anyway, because when it's done wrong, it can, you know, it can be really tragic. I think we've all been there. I mean, I've approached it before and it hasn't worked as well. So on this occasion, I just knew that tonally it was going to work, because I was trying. The reason for using animation and using reconstruction wasn't really because of the treatment of the film. It was because I was trying to get Fergus's personality across. And Fergus was full of fun and full of divilment. And I spent most of my time laughing with him. Like, he was a really funny fecker. So I wanted to get that across. And, you know, when he told me the story about meeting his wife for the first time, you know, I was crying with laughter. So immediately I said, how do I get back there? How do I show this story visually? And there was only one way as far as I was concerned, because you could, I just saw 2D animation and I said, okay. And again, and you'll notice, the minute I went to animators and said, I want to do 2D animation, they were going, are you serious? Are you sure? Like, you know, that we can do this. You know, there was a lot more 3D and beautiful 3D work going on. Yeah, but I was going, no, it needs to be naive. It needs to be
cartoonish.
It needs to be cartoonish. It has to go with the humor. It has to. It was important to have those moments in the film where you gave people a break from what were some harder moments. Yeah. So that, because that was the way Ferg did it. He would make you. He had most of the people around him laughing, so you forgot what he was going through. So it was important to get that into the film as well. And he also had a way of talking about his life as if it was a fairy tale. So it was important that the reconstruction played like one. Like, you're not sure what the hell is really going on or what's happening or what is being said. And that you interpret it in whatever way you like. The most important thing for me was that they place at a point in the film that brings you somewhere else. And that, you know, all my favorite films, I walk out of the cinema and I think about them for a week. And I think about aspects of them and what the filmmaker was trying to say. And I'd hope that's what you get out of this, because he wasn't straightforward, but he was a little bit larger than life, and that's why the film had to be the way it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally warts and all, and it's very, very human. You were there, you get the sense that you were there so much, and often with these kind of films, as direct documentary directors, we might have a small team, but it's a lot of the time it's just you or maybe one other person. Well, how do you get through those moments where it's, you know, you just feel like you're carrying it all yourself? Were you just, you knew you had a vision and stuck to it? Or how did you get through that side of things?
I definitely wouldn't make films this way. But then at the same time, the biggest problem with making a film like this, if you do end up in situations where it's you and a camera, and that's it, and you're filming and you're having to keep an eye on everything that's going on, you're keeping an eye on the audio, you're making sure that you're not getting in the way of what's going on.
Yeah.
So you've no backup. You're dead right. It can be terrifying, but it can be very, very freeing as well, because the people around you, particularly, there are moments when you're traveling with people or you're there in a room, and because it's only you, people don't really pay you much heed. And that's the most important thing, that you blend into the background. When it got to those moments where there was two cameras there, that again is the challenge, to blend into the background. And, you know, you can still have the banter with people as the time goes on, but you're having that banter to, you know, become familiar with them and for them to just, you know, see you as part of what's going on. But when documentary makers, I think, you know, it's good to have a structure around you and a team around you making a documentary. It's very, very tough doing it on your own. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. But I, at the same time, Paul, you know, would I have the same film? Well, definitely not.
Yeah, you definitely get that sense. And like, but you were there for those moments, you know, like, what stage in the story did you actually come, like, had it once come out, or were you seeing all that happen as it happened?
No, I kind of got involved just after Interference got back together and they had done Other Voices. So it was before the film. So it was before the whole Once thing happened.
Yeah.
So I actually, so funnily enough, it could have become a bigger thing, but as you can imagine, you know, during the course of an edit, there are many different ways you could go, and the Once thing could have become a lot bigger. But actually, you know, it suddenly didn't become as big, because for him, he turned up and did a scene for a film called Once. He says it in the film, in Breaking Out. He says, I thought it was going to end up on a Tuesday night in RTE too. I didn't know that the film was gone. And neither did anybody, because maybe we all forget, but at the time, Once didn't get as much attention in Ireland as it possibly should have. You know, I remember going along to see it at the time, and, you know, there were no packed-out cinemas. It was only when it took off in the States that it started getting the attention. And even after the film, things were taken off for Glenn, but that was all happening somewhere else.
Yeah.
And it was only really when Once the musical was happening. Oh, obviously, you know, the great thing about, you know, Glenn's success was that he never forgot, and he went back to the well, and his invite for Ferg to come over and support in Radio City was a massive deal, and hilarious that Fergus would turn around and bring a band as big as he did, and for a moment like that, because I think Glenn at the time would say it himself, he thought that he would come with a quartet, and he came with, you know, a 10-piece band, and turned it into an incredible moment for everybody.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, when the musical came along and Gold became such a pivotal moment in the musical that won 8 Tonys, the disease had progressed to that point that he couldn't actually travel to take advantage of it. And that was the point when it was beginning to get to him, because he always allowed the music to, even though he was losing abilities all the time, he always allowed the music to keep him going. But to be sitting at a remove and watching, you know, this success happen and not to be able to, you know, build on it was really tough for him.
It's a heartbreaking scene when he's invited by Glenn to play in Cork, and you get the sense that maybe he's pushed himself so far, and that maybe everyone around him it almost thinks he's, you know, superhuman, because he seems to suffer almost in silence. And it's heartbreaking when you see him actually say, no, look, I can't do this. I can't perform.
Yeah.
That must have been tough for you as well.
It was, because apart from anything else, the journey from Dublin to West Cork is not a short journey. So there, you know, you would get in a car and you would go down. And I got to be really clear about this. It's only when Fergus passed away that I went back to look at that footage, and particularly the footage over the last year. And I don't think I realised how bad he was. Of course, I probably did, but I was probably too terrified to think about it. But he knew, and he was the only one who did know, because everyone around him just knew he always got on with it. So the fact that he would not go on stage was a massive thing for him, and for the rest of us, it was just a horrible moment where you suddenly realized that this character who didn't let anything get in the way was suddenly getting stopped in his tracks by this disgusting disease.
Yeah. You managed the archive amazingly. There seems to be, you seem lucky in a lot of ways that there was a lot of just really great footage there, but it must have been a challenge as well to try and wrangle it all.
Yeah, I'm very lucky. I mean, you're filming over a period of time, but you know very shortly that it's important that you cover a life here, and that there are moments in this life that you weren't there for. And then you find all the home movies and you go, this is brilliant. This is saying so much. You know that when you have images like that, you don't need to say as much. I was saying to somebody the other day, there was a gentleman called Mark MacDonald who had worked with the band for many years, and he had kept loads of material to do with the band in boxes in his attic. And we spent 3 days going through these boxes, and on the bottom of one box, Aideen and Suri found a blank VHS, and when they put it into a machine, it was Interference playing as Schoolboys in the 80s, and nobody knew it was there. So you got these incredible, you know, bits of luck along the way that meant that you were constantly reevaluating what you wanted, what way, or what was going to end up in the final cut, because you can't tell everything. If you try to tell everything, you're not going to tell anything. So you had to kind of, between myself and McMahon, you just had to decide what were those moments that you needed to hone in on. And anyone who's ever made a documentary will know that up until a certain point in the edit, you're going, I've got this all wrong, this structure is rubbish, it's not working. And then you turn a corner and you go, no, actually, it's going to work. And it's going to work that we took out all that archive and we only left this bit in. But it was a great luxury to have it there, but it was important not to overdo it as well.
Absolutely. What's next for the film, Michael?
That's a great question. I mean, Galway was last year, and Galway was amazing. The Galway Film Fla was the place that I wanted to go with it. They're wonderful people, and I knew what they'd. I knew that once they saw it, well, they do that with all the films in the festival, obviously. But I knew that they'd give it all the help they could, and the screening was incredible. To see people in a cinema react to all the moments that you hope they'd react to, and then, you know, the reception afterwards was incredible. So that you walk away from that, and like anybody, you're kind of going, what's the best path now? And the path is, you want as many people as possible to see the film. So you spend months talking to different people to try and decide what the best way is. Then luckily, Element came on board. And then you're just waiting and waiting for the right time to release. And then, because the thing is, you could go down different roads. You could go online with this, but I wanted it to have a cinema release because I think it's a communal experience. I think every filmmaker wants it to be a communal experience, but in particular with this film, it's all, there are moments in this film where it's like being at a gig. So it's, and when you're sitting in a cinema with people and they're reacting to those moments, that's what I really wanted for it. So it was supposed to be in the Dockfest, and COVID took care of that. Well, before that, it was supposed to get a release, and COVID took care of that in the spring. And now it's been pulled out of Indie Cork. And I mean, I hope and pray, like every filmmaker and everybody involved in film and music in this country, that, I mean, it's a bit weird, to be honest with you, that Fergus spent so many years in his own particular lockdown and frustrated with not being able to get out there and promote his music. And here we are with Breaking Out, and it's in its own personal lockdown. And and he's up there going, for fuck's sake, what is going on? I mean, it's just so weird. But, you know, every day that, you know, you get a little bit low about it, you have to be reminded. I'm reminded that not just of what everybody's going through in our industry, but what he went through as well. And you know, so I think you can plan as much as you like, Paul, but I think it needs a bit of luck. It needs a lot of luck. Because I think, you know, when people see this film, they are affected by it. So I still hope and pray it gets to audience.
Yeah. It has to. Nothing seems to have been easy with this project, but I just hope that people will get to see it, and I know people will love it. What about yourself? Have you got other projects lined up? Or?
Well, I took 2 years out to finish the film. You know, as a filmmaker, when you raise a budget, you put everything into what's on screen. So I'm lucky enough to be working away at the moment on different projects in broadcast television, and I have a few things that I'm working on, but I'm still at the point where I'm trying to make them work enough for me that I go to the next stage. And I suppose it's very, very difficult. I was saying to somebody the other day, I had the pleasure of meeting the makers of Capturing the Freedmans, which is one of my favorite documentaries of all time. And I remember meeting them and say, you know, they were very gracious in asking me about, you know, the film, and I was still in the middle of filming and raising funds at that time. And I said, you know, it's 10 years since Capturing the Freedmans, you know, can you leave a film like that behind? And the director said, no, actually, we're in court next week. You know, you don't leave long-term projects behind. You stay with them and they become like a family member. So Breaking Out's a family member. And, you know, I think quite often when you finish a project, you can move on to the next one. And of course you have to, because you have to live. But I made a promise to myself that I would not give up in trying to push this as much as I could to try and get it out there and to try and, you know, get that bit of luck that it needs.
We always kind of end with this question. If you could give yourself some advice, the younger Michael who was starting out on this journey 10 years ago, what might that be?
Oh, I would have said to myself on loads of occasions over the years, don't start a project like this without a budget. Don't start a project like this without the backing, because it's going to be a long and difficult road otherwise. But actually, at this point, with the film that I've made, you know, I'm glad I didn't stop myself.
Yeah. Sometimes some projects they just need what they need.
Yeah, yeah. And if you manage to finish them without ending up in hospital, you've done well.
Well done. Keep us posted on the release. If there's anything we can do to help promote it, I'd be encouraging everyone to see it in whatever way they can.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate it.
F&I Rap Chat is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network and recorded at the podcast studio in Dublin City Centre. Shoutouts to our sponsors, Wildcard Distribution and Film Equipment Store. This episode was produced and edited by Larry McGann. See you next time on Rap Chat. And before we go, here's another show we recommend that is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Phoning It In is back. Hello, my name is Dave Coffey and I'm the host of Phoning It In, the hilarious improvised phone-in show. Think Joe Duffy meets your favourite Irish comedians. Our first episode back is already out and features the Young Hot Guys, Tony Cantwell, Shane Dan Byrne and Killian Sunderman. This season we'll also have lots of bonus material available on Headstuff Plus, including new improv-style games with all your favourite guests. Phoning It In is available every fortnight wherever you get your podcasts and on the Headstuff Podcast Network. Thanks for listening.